Hello, it's Wednesday 7th of July. I'm Hannah Pearson from Per Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bowerman of Check In Asia and I are delighted to welcome Singapore-based aviation consultant Brendan Sobey to discuss the current status of airlines and air travel in the region. So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today we're excited to be chatting with Brendan Sobey, who is founder of Sobey Aviation, which works with airlines, airports, manufacturers, aviation industry suppliers, banks, and governments in Southeast Asia, Central Asia, and beyond. So Brendan, thanks very much for coming on the show. How are you doing today, and how's daily life in Singapore right now?
It's going pretty well right now. Obviously, like everybody else, just kind of getting fatigue after having not traveled in 16 months. So
I know exactly how that feels. So Brendan, we've got so much to pack into the next 30 minutes. Let's start by going back to the beginning a little bit. Brendan, you were born and educated in the US and you studied labor relations at Cornell University. So how did aviation become your chosen career path?
Yeah, so I mean, I was always interested in aviation growing up. Interested in airlines and airline schedules. And when I was in school, I got my private pilot's license as well. I was involved in journalism through the daily newspaper at Cornell, where I was the managing editor. And basically, I decided I wanted to become an aviation writer and started seeking out jobs shortly after I graduated. I did have a few months doing kind of mainstream media, but didn't particularly like it. So I just ended up getting some jobs at some smaller aviation and aerospace related publications, and after a few years ended up at Flight Global, where I was for about 10 years, and then kind of transitioned more to analysis during my stay at CAPA at 8 years, and then I created my own firm just under 2 years ago. Decided that I really wanted to focus on really in-depth research, white papers, and analytical stuff that I felt that I basically had to do by myself, because it just gave me a lot more independence and ability to do the kind of work I really like doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Gary and I have chosen the same paths for much the same reason. So going back, you said you were senior editor at Flight Global, you became chief analyst at CAPA, which is the Center for Aviation, for 8 years. And that was through much of the 2010s. And that was really a period of rapid expansion in Asia Pacific for aviation. So what are some of your key takeaways from that role in that period as well?
Yeah, no, so it was definitely an interesting period. And I focused mainly on Southeast Asia, specifically for my own writing, for my own analysis reports. And I had a bit of a global role as well, which and at Flight Global, I was fortunate to be based in all three regions, North America, Europe, and Asia during the 10 years there. And I actually, became really interested in Asia, so decided to move back to Asia from 2011, and see a lot of the developments, particularly in Southeast Asia, as I was focusing a lot in Southeast Asia. And this was a period of rapid growth for Southeast Asia, particularly the low-cost carriers. But what always fascinated me was how every market was different. A lot of people try to kind of combine everything into one article or one report, but every market is very different culturally, as well as just business, the way business works, but aviation, how it has developed, how the airlines work, how they distribute, how they communicate, how they really do everything. Even though there's a common theme for growth, of course, every market is very different, and I've always tried to focus on all those markets and understand all 10 of those markets, by doing work in each of those individual countries and reports and projects in each of those individual countries and talking to the airlines and other aviation industry people in each of those countries. So it's evolved some more than others, but a lot of these markets have really changed completely in those 10 years from a market development perspective, again, focusing a lot on LCCs, but just the way the airlines have adapted to basically meet the needs of the growing middle class in this region has been very interesting. And the key takeaway is basically just market evolution, market growth, rapid middle class growth, driving phenomenal air transport growth, and positioning the airlines well from a growth perspective, but not necessarily from a profitability perspective. A lot of airlines, particularly in those latter years, were really struggling profitability-wise, which we might talk about a little bit later.
Yeah, it's a really good point you made there about the 10 different markets and just how diverse this region actually is culturally in terms of business, commerce, all those things. And those differences have really been highlighted by the COVID-19 pandemic. So let's go back to January 2020 when the pandemic was really just starting to emanate from China. At that point, what were your thoughts on how this might impact the airline sector here in Southeast Asia, across Asia Pacific? And when did you really see that impact start to take effect?
Yeah, I mean, there was some impact almost immediately. And in the first month or two, you know, everything was about, you know, who's exposed to China. And this is what we've seen in previous, crises as well. And a lot of people were comparing it back then to SARS and thought that would be, like not a global crisis, but a regional or very China-specific crisis. But of course, even if it's China-specific, everybody in Asia is affected because everybody has a large operation in China, or just about everybody does. So if you look at Southeast Asia, you start looking at which airlines or which markets are heavily exposed to China. They're all somewhat exposed to China, but obviously some are much more exposed to China. And so those airlines and those markets that have more heavy exposure to China than others were more impacted. And we were already starting to talk about that, analyze it. A lot of media attention at the time. But a lot of the assumption then was that this was going to be a very short crisis. And probably, and that it would just kind of like snap back like SARS did, after a few months. And airlines planned that way, which was made it more difficult later on when this crisis became global and became longer and longer. Because if airlines had known at the beginning, if it was a longer, more global crisis, you would plan differently. But of course, 2 months after that, it was the pandemic became global and everything kind of shifted and everybody realized we were going to be in this for a lot longer and it would be very global. And the impact was not just China, which is, 20, 30, 40% of your market, depending on your market, but 97%, 98% of the market was basically evaporated, in a very quick time period in late March of 2020 as the pandemic became global. But even then, a lot of people thought it would just be a few months, and people were talking, let's just wait until the summer. Things will snap back in the summer. Just let's get some, deferrals on payments with leasing companies and just kind of, and again, it was managed in that way that you didn't have to make structural changes or wholesale changes. You just needed like a few months, kind of breather from payments and everything would snap back like kind of like SARS. But of course, after a few months of the pandemic, we realized that wasn't the case either. And this was going to be a lot longer and a lot more brutal than everybody anticipated. And that's when airlines kind of started really thinking about deeper restructurings and bigger changes in terms of negotiations with suppliers. And that was occurring, I guess, around the middle of last year, and since the beginning of the rollout of the vaccines, for that matter, because especially in Southeast Asia, the setback domestically has been much harsher than expected in the first half of this year and into this now third quarter. Back in this December of last year, January this year, everybody was thinking that we'd continue to see positive trends that we saw at least domestically in the fourth quarter of last year, but instead it's gone in the opposite direction, at least in Southeast Asia, with the domestic markets declining in the first quarter versus the fourth quarter, declining in the second quarter versus the first quarter. And unfortunately, I think it's going to happen again in the third quarter versus the second quarter now. Eventually, we'll hopefully start getting out of this in the fourth quarter of this year.
Gosh, I hope so. You were talking about restructuring, and many of the Southeast Asian legacy carriers like Malaysia Airlines, Garuda Indonesia, Thai Airways, Philippine Airlines, they already had pretty heavy debt and structural baggage that they had already brought into the pandemic. So what are the current situations with those airlines? Are they going to survive? What might a future look like for them?
Yeah, so all these airlines were losing money. I mean, some more than others, obviously. But I mean, for the most part, all those airlines were losing, almost every year in the several years prior to the pandemic. They really brought a lot of, inherent issues. There was a lot of longstanding issues that, frankly, would have had to been resolved anyway. These airlines, a lot of them would have needed recapitalization regardless, even without the pandemic. And they had restructurings in recent years that didn't go deep enough. So the longstanding issues, the structural baggage that you were talking about was still there. The problem basically, accelerated and became more urgent because of the pandemic, which in some ways could be a good thing because it forced the governments or the owners to do something sooner rather than later. Now, I don't want to put all the airlines in one kind of lump them all together and say, okay, this is where they are now, because every situation is very different. Like we were talking about, at the beginning, every country is different, but every airline is different as well. And in terms of how they're organized, structured, managed before the pandemic, and also how the government has handled the situation during the pandemic. Besides the fact that they were struggling going in and are struggling now, there's not actually much of a common theme. Everyone is in a different position. Starting with Thai Airways, the government turned its back on Thai Airways very early on by saying, we're not going to put money in, we're just going to throw it into bankruptcy court, which is, you know, not necessarily a bad decision. I think, you know, the government, perhaps made the right choice, because, you know, given the debt there and decision to actually throw an airline into bankruptcy court instead of bail it out sometimes is the right decision. And the bankruptcy in Thai Airways, you know, it's a very slow moving process. Bankruptcy court proceedings vary a lot country by country, as we've seen in even just examples in Southeast Asia, and which courts you use, you know, because some airlines use, you know, or courts in the US or the UK as well. So in Thailand's case, no surprise, it's a very slow process, given you're using the Thai system, which is bureaucratic and slow to begin with. So a year into this bankruptcy, we're starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of, you know, them coming out and restructuring, but a lot still has to be done. They'll definitely be a lot smaller, and they're shedding a lot of their aircraft, and hopefully we'll see more of that in the next few months, especially as we get closer to the reopening of Thailand. So that's Thai's situation. Philippine Airlines, I'll go on there next. They're a little bit different because they're actually not government owned. Philippine Airlines has been in the private sector for many years, and the government there hasn't supported the airline sector, Philippine Airlines or the private airlines, really at all. And they also have been preparing a major restructuring, and they've been preparing actually a Chapter 11 filing in the U.S. Philippine companies often use the U.S. courts for bankruptcy, which, you know, is a sensible move. But they haven't actually filed yet. You know, they were talking about it already like late last year. And, you know, I know that they've been working with a restructuring specialist, Seabury Capital, on this filing. And it's just, they keep on delaying it. I think there's some, you know, internal issues with the private owners, and probably, you know, they want to wait until it becomes a little bit clearer when the recovery is before filing. That's my guess. But the expectation is that they will end up in bankruptcy court. And that they're an airline that was really struggling, overexpanded in the prior years, took on too many aircraft, and will shed a lot of those aircraft as part of the restructuring. So they will become smaller. But, you know, in Philippines example and Thailand's example, actually, the flag carrier is not necessarily the largest airline, especially in the Philippines case, because the LCCs have just become so strong and grown so much.
That's pretty interesting about Thai Airways and Philippine Airlines. Malaysia Airlines and Garuda, what's the current situations with those?
Yeah, so again, each situation very different from for these four airlines. So Malaysia Airlines is I would say, you know, has had the most progress in terms of restructuring by far of those four airlines, and of really almost every airline in Southeast Asia. They went through this UK court restructuring process already a few months ago, and was already completed a few months ago, almost like a partial restructuring, in that they didn't restructured the entire company with the UK court. They only restructured the leases that are with Western leasing companies, which fall under UK law. But they were able to basically complete the renegotiation, the restructuring of all their aircraft leases, while all these other airlines are still working on this. And they have a new business plan, that they've implemented. They actually, you know, haven't cut back that much. Really, only the A380s have been cut. The rest of it is pretty much intact, although, you know, they have some changes in their strategy to some extent. But the question becomes is, you know, the restructuring that they have done, will it be deep enough given how long it's going to take to recover? So, and they also have capital coming in from Khazanah that, you know, was part of this process, you know, where they were able to basically successfully restructure, in part because the leasing companies and the suppliers knew that Khazanah was going to come in and recapitalize the airline. So that helped kind of facilitate the process. For now, they're in relatively better shape because they've completed this process, but that doesn't mean that they won't have to restructure further in the next few years. And then that brings us to Garuda, finally. Garuda, I would say, is the messiest right now because they really didn't do much, if anything, in the first year or 15 months of this crisis in terms of, you know, restructure or attempt to, talk to suppliers. We're very slow in kind of starting the process compared to the other airlines, I would say. But they have started in the last couple of months, and the situation there is very dire because the debt situation, and it's monitored this carefully to see how they go forward, because so far the government hasn't really put in or that much capital or supported it. They're kind of like drip feeding it a little bit for now, but a lot of people are waiting to see, you know, what the government does, because if the government does like what Malaysia did, then that will kind of make it easier for the suppliers to renegotiate, or alternatively, a bankruptcy is possible, like similar to Philippine Airlines and Thai Airways, where they could restructure under bankruptcy court, but it's the slowest one. This remains to be seen with Garuda. But generally speaking, they're going to have to cut back a lot in their international operation, which was very unprofitable in the years prior to the pandemic, focus more on domestic. And then even with their domestic, they probably will focus a lot more on CityLink, which is their low-cost subsidiary. So they're going to become a lot smaller, especially Garuda itself. But CityLink might come out of this in the same size or even larger potentially.
Want to move on to LCCs, but let's briefly talk about Singapore Airlines, because that is slightly different. It has managed to massively recapitalize and restructure. How do you see that coming out of the pandemic in the next few months? It will be significantly slim down, won't it?
You know, their long-term strategy is intact, you know, so they won't necessarily be that much smaller, say, in a few years from now. But, you know, they'll be a bit smaller for the next few years because they've accelerated retirement of aircraft. And even though they're bringing in a lot of new aircraft, even this year, they pushed back kind of, you know, the fleet plans to some extent in that by deferring some of their deliveries and accelerating retirements. You know, aircraft that were going to be retired 3 years from now or 4 years from now have been retired during the pandemic, for example. So they'll be a bit smaller for now, but not too much smaller, I'd say, in the long term. And they have the flexibility to come back earlier because of this investment by the government, and because they, you know, maintained most of their jobs and have kept everything hot and ready to go, so to speak. So they even have the ability to bring back a lot of capacity in the near term, should we be in a fast recovery scenario, which remains to be seen. I'm not really sure that, especially in the international market, we'll have such a fast recovery. But if we do, Singapore Airlines has the ability to add back a lot of capacity very quickly. And they also have a lot of unused capacity right now, in that they're flying more than everybody else internationally, but their load factor is very low. It's like 15%. So they have a lot of ability to carry passengers even without adding capacity at the moment, and then add capacity as well. Also, they have the ability to really take advantage of any consolidation or any other airlines, you know, in the region cutting back in size or potentially folding altogether. Generally, in Singapore Airlines is in a good position because they you know, they've had all this support from the government, and they're in this very strong financial position, and in a position where they can really take advantage of opportunities from other airlines or other hubs, as other hubs in the region, you know, cut back because of what happens in their local market with the local airlines.
So let's talk about low-cost carriers now. And of course, these were really the fulcrum of growth for mass air travel in Southeast Asia over the last decade. But they're not really receiving much state support. Like you keep saying, you know, Q1 2021 was worse than Q4, Q2 is worse than Q1, Q3 doesn't look any better. With all of this stop-start in domestic markets, can LCCs survive? Can they thrive again?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are kind of in this, you know, in this kind of hibernation mode, or where they've cut back a lot and they're just kind of waiting for the market to recover. And a lot of these airlines have not been paying their bills. You know, they haven't been paying leases or most of their leases for, you know, 16, 17 months now. So in some cases, even longer, because some of these airlines were behind in their lease payments even before the pandemic. They're in this period where they're just, you know, unfortunately still waiting for the market to really recover. And then once the market recovers, then they basically put in place programs to try to get back in the air, you know, their aircraft and to work with their suppliers and renegotiated contracts and ability to repay, you know, what they owe, or some of what they owe at least. So it's a very difficult situation, but so far the suppliers have not, like, you know, pulled the trigger in terms of like repossessing aircraft or trying to force bankruptcy filings. But at some point, some of that could happen, and that's, I think, the risk right now, because if Southeast Asia, you know, doesn't start get going later this year, the risk is that it will fall behind the other regions. And if that happens, then I think a lot of the companies that have been very patient with the airlines in this region, you know, particularly the privately owned LCCs that don't have the government support, you know, they can start losing patience and repossessing aircraft and not working with these airlines, at least to the same extent. But hopefully that won't happen. Hopefully, you know, the market will start picking up at least in the fourth quarter, you know, with more solid domestic recovery and eventually international, you know, and hopefully these airlines, you know, they carry so much of the traffic and they're and some of, especially the larger ones, they have such a large fleet there. They qualify for this like too big to die or too big to fail scenario because there's so much exposure by manufacturers, leasing companies and other suppliers to some of these LCC groups that, you know, they really, really don't want to see these airlines fail. So they kind of have that going for them as well. But eventually, you know, something has to give and they have to work out their future and have a viable plan.
Brendan, we've spoken a lot there about LCCs. We've spoken about the state carriers. But what about the airline landscape as we move forward? We're starting to see some new cargo carriers being introduced, a new LCC in Indonesia. There are LCCs applying for air operating licenses in South Korea. Greater Bay Airlines coming up in Hong Kong. Do you think that the air landscape might change? Will we see these new airlines? Will they be able to gain momentum in the market?
Yes, so, I mean, some of the airlines potentially can. I mean, there's a huge advantage to starting an airline right now because you have this access to very cheap aircraft because leasing companies are, they don't really have any options in terms of the aircraft that they have, you know, available that are not placed. And also, you know, other, you know, you can get good deals on a lot of other things. And you could also have access to pilots now as well, which is something that was always more challenging because of the pilot shortage, you know, prior to the pandemic. So this is, in a way, a great time to start an airline. You're also starting with a clean sheet of paper, especially if the market, you know, kind of changes. You can kind of be more flexible if you're a new airline to adapting to whatever those changes are. So I think a lot of these airlines will start and, you know, how successful they'll be, I think, remains to be seen. A lot of it might hinge on how much the existing airlines really, you know, how much they shrink or how many of them actually, you know, fade from the scene entirely. So far, you know, we haven't had many airline collapses in Southeast Asia. We've only had like a couple of really small airlines shut down, which is Nokscoot and Indonesia AirAsia X. These are just smaller affiliates of the LCC groups that weren't really significant to begin with. There hasn't been many airlines, you know, fade or shut down. And there might not be going forward. There might be a few more, but there might not be that many. And then, you know, then the question becomes, is there overcapacity again in the market, which is the issue we had prior to the pandemic? And is that exacerbated by these new airlines? So the new airlines, you know, especially if they're well capitalized and, you know, some of them might have some really eager, ambitious investors. So I do think we will see some new airlines, you know, maybe not all of them, but quite a few new airlines. But we also probably will see a return of overcapacity and irrational competition, which is in the long term not necessarily good for the market, but we'll have to see how this shakes out. Maybe we won't see consolidation during the pandemic or that much, but we might see consolidation like 4 years from now when it becomes clear that there's just too many competitors and there's other options for the suppliers and leasing companies to not necessarily have to renegotiate or work with the airlines that are struggling, but actually to kind of pull the plug on some of these airlines.
Watch this space. So ASEAN and the EU recently signed an air transport agreement. How will that work in practice? And what airlines, which routes stand to benefit the most from this?
This deal, I mean, you know, it's a long-term thing. First of all, they've been negotiating this for several years. So this is not something that the pandemic created. It was like 98% done prior to COVID, actually. And it's a long-term thing. It's not about, you know, trying to help, you know, airlines recover in this initial period. It's more about, you know, having a more liberal market over the long term. And over the long term, we'll have to see, you know, how much impact this has, because the market, you know, is relatively liberal between ASEAN and EU already. So basically, prior to this kind of larger block deal, you know, you have, you know, individual air service agreements or bilaterals between all the individual countries. And if you look at these individual agreements, particularly like, you know, the ones for Thailand and Singapore, because that's where most of the flights to Europe from Southeast Asia are from, these agreements, you know, that were already in place were relatively liberal, which means that they already had, in many cases, unlimited rights. And in many cases, they had fifth freedom rights and beyond rights, which is basically passengers beyond Europe or beyond ASEAN or hop around within those regions to kind of combine flights and you know, carry local passengers even within those regions. There might not be that many examples where this actual deal you know, leads to, you know, something that wasn't possible previously. But I mean, there could be a few examples that do come out. I mean, there actually was already one that's already come out with KLM saying they want to operate from KL to Phuket as kind of a combined route. So I mean, there might be a few other examples like that. But in the end, ultimately, I don't think there'll be a significant difference in terms of more flights or more options. But the overall idea, the concept that ASEAN and EU is working together, that certainly has a lot of positive implications. They can work more in other areas in the aviation spectrum, such as on safety and other regulations. So it's definitely a positive overall, but I just don't think it will have a huge impact on the market.
It's interesting that we now have an air transport agreement between ASEAN and EU, but we don't yet have an intra-ASEAN air agreement, do we? They've been talking about that for, what, a decade? What's the current status with that, and why hasn't it happened?
Well, there was an intra-ASEAN agreement that was implemented about 5 years ago. But it hasn't had an impact, so maybe that's why nobody's been talking about it. There is basically open skies within ASEAN now based on this agreement. Now, it doesn't allow domestic cabotage rights, which is, you know, so an airline from like Malaysia can't fly domestically in Indonesia. But in terms of between the countries and also for the most part, freedom rights, which is basically combining, you know, two countries on a single route that has been available now for 5 years. But it hasn't had an impact because by the time this deal came out, you know, the market was relatively liberal already. You know, the LCCs had already expanded, and the issue was more slots. So even though traffic rights were readily available, you couldn't get slots at the major airports. So the traffic right was kind of irrelevant, moot. The ASEAN Open Skies Agreement really hasn't had an impact. So that kind of provides some context to ASEAN EU and other potential ASEAN deals that they've been working on. There's also ASEAN-China, which hasn't really had much of an impact. And, you know, they've been talking about ASEAN-New Zealand. There might be ASEAN-UK now that UK is out of the EU. In fact, they're talking about that already. There might be ASEAN-Korea, ASEAN-Japan. All these things are, there's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing negative, but there's just not much of an impact usually.
So talking about ASEAN then, one of the issues, I guess, that you've been pursuing since the pandemic is this idea of an ASEAN travel corridor. Which, you know, I feel like ASEAN have been talking about this for a very long time now, since the beginning of the pandemic, and we've seen no real action on it. Do you think it's likely to come off?
It doesn't seem like it's going to happen, but just ASEAN as you said, they've been talking about this for several months. I think they first brought this up around November of last year. And I mean, this travel corridor is would only be for essential business travel. So it's similar to kind of like the green lanes that we had in place between several countries. Singapore in particular had several green lanes, although a lot of them more recently became suspended, where they were allowing, you know, quarantine-free business travel. But there was a lot of restrictions and there was quotas in terms of the number of people that could travel on these. So it wasn't like it wasn't very significant in terms of generating a volume of air traffic. Of course, there was no leisure travel allowed. But it is a start, at least. And, you know, I think it really depends on what happens over the next few months, because, you know, we're getting to the phase where markets are starting, or countries are starting to open up generally. You know, it might not be a full reopening, but at least a select reopening to like countries that have high vaccination rates or low case levels. So all this kind of, you know, stuff that's kind of more specific to two countries, whether it's an air travel bubble or a green lane or a travel corridor, you know, maybe become a little bit moot. Now, of course, for ASEAN, you know, that's a little bit different because, you know, you have all 10 countries. So, you know, there could be some justification to get this thing going, you know, but they would have to do it soon because, you know, during this kind of interim period before leisure travel resumes, if they could allow essential business travel to kind of resume, that would be obviously a positive step. But, you know, whether, you know, given the progress so far and given the fact that, you know, we're talking about a general reopening maybe in a few months, hopefully, then, you know, again, it might become a little bit moot. But I think ASEAN, you know, has to continue to work together. I mean, I think They also started talking about an ASEAN vaccine passport, you know, but they started talking about that in March, and that thing, that is also basically stalled. It doesn't look like it's going to happen. That's I think, more important, you know, maybe not a passport if that's not possible, but at least more consensus in terms of recognition of vaccines, so that every country kind of recognizes everybody else's vaccine, and that there's some kind of mechanism to basically facilitate resumption of travel based on mutual vaccine recognition. And that hasn't happened in ASEAN yet.
So just before we wrap up, we've got time for one more quick question, Brendan. Let's really talk about the reopenings. As you said, you've set out the scenarios for the rest of the year. We are concerned about the Delta variant, perhaps the emergence of another variant, which really would throw even more spanners into the works. But let's look a little bit about Phuket initially and what the airlines are responding to that. Now, one of the benefits before the pandemic was that inter-ASEAN traffic really supported leisure travel, particularly into destinations like Thailand. At the moment, that's not really possible. Thailand produced this list of 66 countries and territories that could fly into Phuket. But most ASEAN markets are still closed. Singapore Airlines is flying into Phuket. So at the moment, when you reopen a country in ASEAN, you have to look to longer haul markets, don't you? At the moment, Asia Pacific, not just Southeast Asia, really isn't an option.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Phuket sandbox is, you know, geared around the long haul markets. You know, those markets that, you know, are open in terms of outbound and allowing vaccinated travelers to leave and come back without quarantine. So basically that eliminates all of Asia Pacific. And so you're left with Europe, Middle East, North America. Not every country, of course, in those regions are included in the list of 66. And some of them might not be open from an outbound perspective either, but a lot of them are, at least for vaccinated travelers. So the idea here is really to start reopening based on those long-haul markets. And hopefully, eventually, people within Asia will be able to travel again. And of course, it's critical because if you look at Thailand or other markets, most of the travelers are from China and other countries in Asia Pacific. Australia is a very important source market for Bali and other places. And Australia might be like one of the last places that reopens from an outbound perspective. China, of course, is the most important by far in ASEAN. And in many countries, is counts for an overwhelming majority of travelers. But again, China reopening from an outbound perspective is not about to happen anytime soon either. So the focus is for now on what's available, and that is the long haul market, which is you know, that's just the reality of it. A lot of people were talking even a few months ago, but also throughout the crisis, how this would be, the recovery would be domestic, then regional, then long haul. But that's not really going to happen in ASEAN. Everything is just still closed. It will be for a while, at least from a regional and international perspective. And from a domestic perspective, of course, things have been set back. But, you know, that could, you know, reopen, you know, as vaccination rates improve and as containment levels improve as well. So, but from an international perspective, yeah, it's really just about the long haul markets at this point. And it could be a while before we see a resumption of full international travel and regional international travel in ASEAN.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think probably this time last year, when anybody would have asked you or us, how is travel going to reopen? I think everybody would have guessed it's going to be regional first in Southeast Asia and then long haul, but it's actually just turned out to be completely the opposite. So one last question for you, Brendan. So normal times, you're a really frequent flyer. You've obviously been stuck in Singapore, not able to really travel very far. Where's your next trip going to be?
Yeah, well, this goes back to the last question. I mean, I'll be realistic. So, because, you know, you can, regional opened up, then of course a short holiday within ASEAN would be the easiest thing to do, just because I haven't had a holiday in so long. But with long haul likely opening up first, realistically, it's going to be long haul. And I'm from the U.S., so, you know, going back to visit my family is probably the first trip. And it might be sooner rather than later, at least I'm hoping that. Might have an opportunity to go to the U.S. and other long-haul markets as well before the regional opens up.
Brendan, thank you so much for coming onto the show. And hopefully we can get you back on the show later in the year when, hopefully, things are starting to move, even if it's still slowly. In the meantime, Brendan, where can our listeners find you? How can they get links to what you do?
Yeah, I mean, so the easiest way is to follow me on LinkedIn. The other way is, of course, my website.
Amazing. And I'll drop the link to your LinkedIn profile and your website on our show notes too. So that brings us to the end of today's aviation special edition of the show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed with Brendan or what we missed out. You can drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep, and of course you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Overcast, Podcast Addict, Stitcher, and now Amazon Music. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And please remember, if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, take time to rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
So that's a wrap for today, and we look forward to talking travel and tourism again with you very soon.